The only way I've learned to express myself through other people's descriptions of life. I'm Blake Murphy. That's Motion City Soundtrack. A little light on a lyric, so a little reflection on the exercise of using lyrics to express how the Blue Jays are doing, how we're feeling about them. The Jays didn't play yesterday. Wasn't a day short of news, though, because as things continue to settle, post-draft, post-trade deadline and things like that, a couple minor updates. Paolo Espino option to the minors. That clears a spot for Ryan Yarbrough, who was acquired on the deadline and is expected to join the team in New York today. Nick Raposo was claimed off of waivers from the St. Louis Cardinals and option to AAA. That kind of backfills the Brian Servin spot, with Servin having backfilled the Jansen spot. It's not a meaningful one. It's another kind of Servin Heinemann type, albeit with even less of a bat at the AAA level. But yeah, you need catcher depth, and Phil Clark was probably the next man up if they needed another one. Always good to have extra catchers kicking around at AAA. And then the Blue Jays signed 19 draft picks yesterday, so 19 of the 21 guys that they selected in the actual draft, including Treya Savage, which we mentioned on the show yesterday. They also signed 11 undrafted free agents. So down in the minor leagues, things will continue to turn. A lot of guys changing levels, making debuts at new levels, getting bumped up, bumped down, released, added. It's been a little chaotic. Our first guest today knows what that is like at the minor league level, and now he knows what it's like at the major league level when the roster, a third of the roster, is turning over. It's Ben Schulman of Sportsnet. He is on the TV calls for this weekend series in New York. Ben, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Like you mentioned coming out of break there, it's been a busy time for sure, but it's been a lot of fun, and it's always cool to have new players joining the organization.
So you've done this in minor league baseball, and I'd imagine this time of year is like even more chaotic there because you have new draft guys coming in and then trades and guys changing levels and things like that. Is that a fair read? Like, obviously the Jays just changed over a third of their roster over the course of a week, so maybe that ranks higher, but generally, like, this week or two here after draft signings has got to be nuts covering an A-ball team.
Yeah, I mean, in my specific situation, especially with the 2022 Fort Wayne Tin Caps, who were a San Diego affiliate, the Padres traded for Juan Soto and Josh Hader within the span of days, and then had to trade away Eric Hosmer and attach prospects to that to shed his salary. So that was kind of similar, where half your roster goes. And I think maybe the best, the thing that separates it, I would say, is in the major leagues, people are talking about who's going to go all the time. So you have an idea that all of the UFAs are probably going to be traded from the Blue Jays. And then you might get a little surprised by an Isaiah Kiner-Falefa or a Nate Pearson. In the minor leagues, you don't really have a great idea of who is being looked at from the team that you're calling for and who isn't. So everyone leaving comes as a surprise because your top prospect or an organizational guy could get moved, and you really have no idea of knowing who other teams are looking at. So it gets pretty chaotic in the minors for sure. And there's a lot of movement always, but it seems to speed up a ton at that time. And probably even more if you're working for a minor league team that's with San Diego or Seattle or one of these organizations that seems to be trading perennially.
And oh, by the way, in your off season, you also do Raptors 905, where the roster can change like this. Like they're putting guys, literally this past year, they're putting guys in Ubers and driving an hour to make a game in time, so you have enough players to play. So you're built for this, man. You are built for a week like this. What was it like down in Baltimore? So this was a chaotic week, obviously, for all the transactions. There were also four games in a 48-hour span. You guys had a doubleheader. We got a rain delay in there. The Kikuchi trade comes down between games. You and Joe Siddle were great on the call and seemed to have a lot of fun with it. What were those couple days like in Baltimore?
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun. It was definitely about the busiest series I've ever had with the mention of the four games in 48 hours plus the trade deadline in the middle. I think Joe and I both felt like we were trying to focus on the games as much as possible, but it was really hard to accomplish that with how many trades were being executed in the middle of each day. Like Justin Turner was in the starting lineup the day he got traded. He had a hit and made a diving play, and then all of a sudden he's not out there for the second inning and Addison Barger's on the field. And, you know, and then Barger hits his first major league home run and Jackson Holliday hits his first major league home run. So it was busy in the best kind of way. There was a lot going on there, and the weather at least cooperated enough for us to get the four games in. So it was a ton of fun, but it's a series unlike any series I've ever done before.
Yeah, and Jackson Holliday just missed the second one in that game too. So the other thing you get to, in addition to getting to call these games and you do the Justin Turner hug watch and Kikuchi between games, you know, you got boots on the ground in Baltimore. You're in that locker room before games, and I don't know if you do the post game as well, but I would imagine, you know, you got a sense of how things were. How was that aspect of it? And that, I mean, obviously everyone's sad to see Danny Jansen and Yusei Kikuchi and Justin Turner leave. I'd imagine there is also some sense of, and maybe this is something you don't feel until this weekend series, but it's done now, right? Like, nobody has to worry anymore about if they're getting dealt and where they're going to be and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could feel that after the deadline had cleared going into the last game, because kind of the deadline day or that day of trading, especially with the doubleheader, it felt like there was a little bit of an understandable kind of nervous or anxious energy, because a whole bunch of guys didn't know if they were going to be traded or not and where they were going to be traded. And so you're in the starting lineup and you're getting ready for a game, but you might get dealt before that game even starts. And I think to just have that done with is probably a little bit of a weight off everyone's shoulders. I would think if you're a contender or not a contender, it probably serves both ways. So I think that, you know, things are probably going to be a lot more calmed down now, like you mentioned, especially for this weekend and going forward, because you kind of know what the situation is and who is going to be on the team for the most part. So I think guys now who are veterans are settling in and probably focusing on getting the best out of their individual seasons. And obviously the pressure is still high or getting higher for young and less established guys who now have a big opportunity in front of them and have to make use of that if they want to be a part of the plans going forward.
Yeah. And that, okay. So that's where I want to take the discussion here. And look, there's still, I'm aware of the fact we're still going to be talking about some of the trade stuff here for a little bit. It's still deadline week. You know, we'll get another look at Joey Loperfido. At some point, we'll see Jake Bloss or Will Wagner or whatever. We're not done that, but let's you and I turn the focus to the actual games at hand here. What are we looking at from a lineup perspective the rest of the way? Obviously, this has created a lot of opening for opportunity for guys. You know, I don't think you're going to see them, you know, sit down Vlad or George Springer all that often or anything like that. But there are like six spots in the lineup that on a given day you could make a case for, hey, this guy should get a longer look. This guy should get a longer look. Who or what is kind of front of mind for you when you're looking at the lineup card day to day now?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of different lineups. First off, I think that it's going to be pretty mixed around. But when you take, you know, Danny Jansen being traded and Justin Turner being traded and Bo Bichette not with the team right now due to injury and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa being traded, a lot of guys that weren't necessarily at the top of the order are probably going to get up there. You know, I still think you have Springer and Vlad in their established spots. Horwitz probably occupies a lot of the top of the order. They've had him at cleanup the last couple days, and I don't know if that'll stick or not. I feel more like he'll end up hitting number two, but I think Varsho gets up there a lot. I think Kirk, who has had a better couple of weeks, will probably get up there a lot. It seems like Ernie Clement is getting some opportunities. It would be hard for me to imagine that Addison Barger hasn't bought himself a little bit more playing time recently with what he's done. And, you know, the Blue Jays can kind of rotate a couple different guys through left field and through third base with the fact that Kevin Kiermaier is not with the team and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa is not with the team anymore. So I think that, you know, I see more of the established guys pushing up to the top of that lineup. But then again, Joey Loperfido hit second in his Blue Jay debut. And they might, you know, I didn't see that coming. They might want to test some of these guys in spots like that and just see how they respond, not in terms of only results on the field, but demeanor and stuff that we can't always see from up at the broadcast booth or in the clubhouse before and after games. So it'll be interesting to see with guys like Loperfido, Clase, Will Wagner, where they slot them into the order, because it does feel like some of them have the potential, if they, you know, can reach their full capabilities, to be guys who hit near the top of that order. And maybe this is kind of a good opportunity to get them up there while Bo Bichette is still injured and while you kind of have spots at two or at four a little bit more open than usual.
Yeah, and this is obviously not something that translates directly because it's the minor leagues, but Class A and Wagner hit 1-2 for Buffalo yesterday. Class A got a hit and a stolen base. Wagner had a pair of hits in his Bison's debut, so some good stuff there. And then, yeah, you can always do the – My thought with Class A, I like this lineup structure generally. If you're going to have like a George Springer leading off, he's the nine hitter. And then it's like, you know, it's the second leadoff mentality of like, oh, you still got the speed. You still got a guy who can move it. But like, if George Springer is going to hit first because he's George Springer, then maybe you do that. You mentioned Addison Barger there. When it comes to Addison Barger, like we all know the big swing. We all know the AAA numbers and things like that. How much of the rest of the way here do you think should be focused on figuring out what position he is good at if he's in the major leagues? Like, obviously, the arm is there. He has the hardest thrown ball of any Blue Jays outfielder this year and the hardest thrown ball of any Blue Jays infielder this year, but hasn't looked, like, super comfortable at any of the spots. Where do you think he landed or where do you think they try him out here kind of the rest of the way?
Yeah, if I'm them, I focus a lot on third base, left field. I know that right field was his more natural position in the outfield, at least at AAA. But the fact of the matter is they have a right fielder locked in for the next two seasons after this, and the opportunity just really isn't there. So if I'm the Blue Jays, I would give him some third base reps for certain and see what he can do over there. You know, you can have Ernie Clement play shortstop a fair amount, or you can have him at second base if you need to, and you can have Leo Jimenez at short. And left field feels like the open spot right now where there is a lot of competition, granted, but there is probably an opportunity to have left field filled by one of the internal guys next year. So I really feel like third base should get an extended run to see what he can do there, because you probably have Lo Perfetto, Class A, and pending free agents in the offseason competing for that left field spot. Third base feels like more opportunity, but I would give him some run at both, because if he was way more comfortable in left field than he was at third base after getting playing time there, then obviously you want to make that decision. He's at least played some left field now that he's been at the major league level.
With respect to Joey Lo Perfetto, obviously we can read the prospect reports and see the stats in AAA. And look, he's had some major league time. It hasn't gone particularly well, but the larger sample there and across the minor leagues and the scouting reports and things like that is this is a very interesting, fourth outfielder, at least maybe someone who can play into a bigger role down the line. What are you looking for from him this next little bit as we get to know him?
Yeah, I think one thing that a lot of people have said about him is can he hit, you know, the high fastball at the top of the zone? And I think that's something to watch for. His one hit that he hit really hard in his Blue Jay debut was a pitch left at the lower portion of the plate. And I think he's demonstrated pretty well that he can do a lot of damage with those types of pitches and hit for a lot of power. So can he just be, you know, more consistent? And granted, like you said, you know, I've only watched a handful of his games and so have a lot of people that have scouted him. So there could be, you know, more there than we know, but can he contend a little bit more with the top of the zone pitches and be able to, you know, cover a little bit more of that plate? Because it seems like when he hits the ball, he's going to hit it really hard, and he's very athletic and fast and can play a good outfield. So for me, that seems like the thing to watch for. And if he can consistently, you know, make some good contact with pitches up and really hammer pitches down, that could be a serious weapon for the Blue Jays, who haven't had great balance in their lineup with left-handed hitting for a while.
Yeah, now they have a curious lineup configuration now if they face a left-handed pitcher like they will on Saturday against Carlos Rodon, is that Lo Perfetto, Barger, and Horwitz are all lefties, and lefties with question marks about their lefty-on-lefty ability. So that'll be maybe that's a Luis De Los Santos, Leo Jimenez, Stuart Baroa kind of day there. When it comes to obviously everyone now, you know, Vlad and Springer and Varsho and Kirk, they have their spots for 2025. Everyone else is kind of, this is the start of the training camp battle, right? Or spring training battle. Who do you think has the most on the line in terms of like fringe roster or like that idea that you could go from a bench piece to, you know, an everyday guy in the plans? Like, obviously every one of these guys has a lot on the line. I would imagine, you know, if you're Brian Servin, if you're Luis De Los Santos, it's probably a little less because of what your future looks like. But some of these guys, this is a high leverage couple months here.
Yeah, you know, I think I look at David Schneider. You know, he has a decent amount on the line. I think he's proven himself to be a guy on the major league team, but I think the ups and downs of this year, there's probably still a worthy question of how often would he play on the major league team and what kind of role would he fill. So I think there's definitely a lot on the line for him. You know, Spencer Horwitz, really hot start. It slowed down a little bit recently, and I think, you know, there's a question to whether he could be their starting second baseman next year or and feature at first also if Vlad moves to third or DHs a little bit more. Or is he a guy that they have platooning a little bit more in a situation like that? So I think those two have a lot going right now. You know, I think Barger, to a certain extent, is also, you know, trying to at least prove himself to be a bench piece going forward for next year after a bumpy start. He is starting to hit really well, and maybe there's something there for Addison Barger to show that at a minimum, he can be kind of that lefty power bat that they were trying to harness off the bench early in the season with Daniel Vogelbach or the signing of Joey Votto. So I look at those three the most. You know, I see a guy like Ernie Clement as having proven probably that he fits a role that he can play a couple times a week in a couple different spots and provide high contact. And, you know, guys like Leo Jimenez or even Lo Perfido or Clase, probably just, you know, younger and less experienced to the point where if they were to struggle now, I don't know that it means their opportunities are gone for the future. It obviously doesn't help, but I think they probably have a little bit more runway being their relative age and experience at the major league level.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a good read on it. That seems like there's a... Yeah, a lot on the line for some of these guys, man. Which is fun. I'd imagine it's two minds. And look, these guys are competitive and confident enough that they probably have like a little bit of the anxieties about it. But I would be a mess. I would be like, I can't mess this up. Like this is such a high level. They're probably like, I get to play every day in the majors. You get to call a series this weekend at Yankee Stadium with Buck Martinez. I know you've done a lot of cool stuff in your career already. You've been to these ballparks and stuff like that. But calling one for TV at Yankee Stadium alongside Buck, how fired up are you?
Oh, it's awesome. It definitely, I mean, it's a dream come true. I've been looking forward to it the entire season. It's the one of, if not the most unique atmosphere in baseball, and it still has the look of an old Yankee Stadium, and you could feel the history with Monument Park and everything like that. It's just, it's a special place, I think, for baseball and in the history of the game, and to get to do it and do it alongside Buck, it's going to be a blast. I'm really, really looking forward to it. I had a couple near misses at Syracuse because they play some football games at Yankee Stadium, and that wouldn't have been exactly the same, but almost got to call some games there and then wondered if I'd get the chance again. And to have this opportunity it's just thrilling. I really, really can't wait for the game coming tonight.
So you look at a lineup, if you're the Blue Jays, that has Aaron Judge in it, and Aaron Judge is lapping the league in OPS plus. He's already almost at 40 home runs. I think Bobby Witt Jr. is the only player with more wins above replacement, and that is, you know, because he plays shortstop. And then Juan Soto is second in OPS plus and third in wins above replacement. I know that they maybe didn't do enough at the deadline to solidify around those guys. Jazz Chisholm School, they just got Giancarlo Stanton back. But, man, how do you... I don't mean to put this on you because nobody in the history of baseball has had an answer for this, but how do you deal with a lineup that has two guys hitting at that? Like, I don't know that we've seen a 1-2 performing this well at the same time.
Yeah, I think you have to pitch around them as much as possible, frankly. And I know that a lot of guys are competitors and don't want to do that, but I think you have to put yourself in a good spot for when they come up. If you walk two guys before Juan Soto comes up, you're in trouble. If you know, get into a really deep inning and there's runners on the corners and Aaron Judge comes up, you still might want to walk him to load the bases. I think that you really have to try and make them not beat you, because as much as they're competitors and as much as you want to go after these guys, they are really tough to beat. And almost every single game, one of them is going to homer off you, or they're going to come up with a bases clearing double. They're going to do something that really tilts the game. And as much as you can take them out of the game is the best that you can do. Not that the Yankees don't have other talent. I mean, getting Giancarlo Stanton back, I think, has been big for them over the last couple of days. Jazz Chisholm, you know, has been an addition to the Yankee lineup, at least early on. We'll see if his four homers in four games continues, you know, and maybe one of them was hit off a position player, but we won't care too much about that. But I think that you really have to try to avoid these guys, because they are one of the best 1-2 punches, I think, in the history of baseball. And I know it's easy to get really biased in terms of what you're looking at right now, but I would imagine that 20 years from now, the numbers will hold up that Aaron Judge and Juan Soto at this point in their careers were as tough of a 1-2 punch as Trout and Ohtani, and as a lot of the great duos that existed in the 100-plus history of baseball before that. So as much as you can avoid them would be best. I mean, the Blue Jays managed a series split at home against the Yankees in a four-game set a couple weeks back. The Yankees were in a tough spot, and the Blue Jays had a very different roster than they have right now. But, you know, they still have a lot of the pitching that they had, especially going this weekend. And if those guys can just, for the most part, stay away from Judge and Soto, a walk is not the worst outcome, I think, against those two guys when you have the opportunity to issue it.
If you do put them on base, though, and Jazz Chisholm comes up, don't throw a 56-mile-an-hour Ephus pitch right down the middle. That'll be a tough one. You like the Jazz addition for them? Like, again, I question if they did enough at the deadline as a team that's kind of right there. The asking price on Jazz was obviously pretty high. Do you like what they did at the deadline, Jazz, and then just kind of only tweaking the bullpen a little bit with Mark Leiter Jr.?
I would have done more, especially in the bullpen. I think I could have got behind, you know, some of their offensive players having better second halves than they did first halves, and understanding that they already do have that 1-2 punch. And if they can just get a little bit of early season Volpe and Stanton coming back, and maybe a guy like LeMahieu figures it out a little bit, or Ben Rice gets back on track from his early production, I could see why, you know, adding Chisholm to that lineup makes you feel strong enough about the lineup going forward. I think, you know, he's a good player, you know, and has provided pretty solid production while playing multiple positions. The bullpen, I would have done more. I think that they really lack strikeout stuff. And I think most people around the Yankees would tell you that they just haven't, you know, had enough shut down guys where they come in and punch out people in big situations, and they've pieced it together a lot and had a big rotation of lots of different guys in their bullpen throughout the year. Lots of guys claimed off waivers or acquired in minor trades, just trying to fit it all together. I think they really could have used a back end guy. I'm not saying replace Clay Holmes. I know that he struggled recently, but I still believe in him overall. But I would have put a couple guys right beside Clay Holmes if I were them, and they just they weren't able to get that done. You know, I think if you have you know, a Pete Fairbanks in your bullpen pitching the eighth inning right before Clay Holmes, or if they were the team that went out and got Jason Adam, albeit the asking price was pretty high for him, I think that I look at it a little bit different. I like Mark Leiter Jr., but that wouldn't have been my entire addition to the bullpen.
Yeah, that's it left me scratching my head a little bit of just like, you know, you're tied for the division lead here. You're the Yankees. You've got, like, how many times are you going to have Aaron Judge and Juan Soto hitting at this level and healthy? And I don't know, it's I do wonder sometimes, like, obviously the three wildcard era has made more teams buyers, the meaty part of the middle, but I do wonder if the extra randomness of the playoffs has made teams like a little less aggressive at the very, very top.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, you saw the Dodgers for many years be the best team in baseball and not go through. I mean, the Phillies have almost done the opposite, often contending from the wild card or the bottom. But I still would have done something more. You know, you just don't know that Juan Soto is going to be a New York Yankee next year. He could be a Met. He could be a Dodger for all we know. Like, they could do something crazy. He could go anywhere. And so to not push all your chips in when you guaranteed have Juan Soto on your team for the next couple months and a playoff run where historically he's been pretty good in the playoffs, not just with Washington, but they also made that NLCS run with the Padres the first year he was there. I feel like you got to do everything that you can this year and kind of throw caution to the wind, because if you're able to get that title, even if the next couple of years aren't as good as you want, you kind of buy some leeway. So I would have pushed more chips in, but Brian Cashman is a very successful front office executive over the course of multiple decades. So perhaps there's something we don't know. Maybe their pickup of Aniel De Los Santos is going to turn out to be some huge steal in a big Yankee way, like when Chase Headley came over to the Yankees and went nuts, and or Matt Carpenter, and we just won't have seen it coming.
Sure, yeah, Cashman, a lot of success, but no World Series since 2009, and that's a long time if you're the New York Yankees. And yeah, you're right. Juan Soto is going to be a Blue Jay next year, so you should get it in while you can. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Have an awesome time this weekend.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Ben Schulman of Sportsnet. He will be on the call with Buck Martinez and Hazel May for this entire series down at Yankee Stadium in New York. It's a 7:05 start tonight, 1:05 start tomorrow, 1:35 start on Sunday. It's Kevin Gausman against Marcus Stroman tonight, Jose Berríos against Carlos Rodon on Saturday, and then Yariel Rodriguez against TBD on Sunday. The TBD because Gerrit Cole's been dealing with injuries, pulled from his last start that opened the window for Will Warren to make his major league debut. Gerrit Cole's expected to throw a bullpen today to see how he feels. That would determine his status from Sunday. So maybe we find that out later, maybe we don't. But right now, that's a TBA. I mentioned Jonathan Class A and Will Wagner and their debuts yesterday. Wanted to make note of a couple of the other debuts around the system. So Class A, it wasn't his debut. He had played a couple games for Buffalo now, but hitting a stolen base leading off. Will Wagner had a two-hit day. Josh Rivera had a two-hit day in his system debut. Yohindrick Pinango had a hit and a walk. Cutter Coffey struck out four times but had a hit. And then Arjun Amala had a three-hit day. We talked a lot about him yesterday and how hot he's been. That was the first three-hit day of his minor league career. The only downer on the minor league side yesterday was Connor Cook, who is the reliever at AAA that has, I mean, he's walking too many guys. The ERA is a little high, but the slider is a nasty wipeout swing and miss pitch. He was probably in the mix for a bullpen look in September at some point. They'd have to add him to the 40 man. But given the quality of that pitch, he was probably at least on the radar for a look. He left the game hurt yesterday. We didn't have an update on that last I saw. So, yeah, that's a bit of a downer. And I mentioned earlier a couple roster moves heading into this weekend series, minor ones. To be sure, Paolo Espino option down. Ryan Yarbrough will take that spot. And then Nick Raposo was claimed off of waivers from St. Louis and optioned to Buffalo. That's just catcher depth. The Jays didn't have a third catcher on their 40-man. They could have bumped, you know, a Phil Clark or someone like that from AAA. But you would need extra AAA depth anyway after calling Brian Servin up. So Raposo is a guy, he was like an undrafted signing by St. Louis back in 2021. This was his second year at AAA. Not much bat there. Obviously, I don't have eyes on what a guy looks like behind the plate at AA and AAA in another farm system. But yeah, not a lot to not a lot of bat to speak of there. He was hitting a .193 at AAA in the Cardinals system. We're going to take a break here. The rest of the show should be fun. We're going to talk to Chris Cotillo, get the Red Sox side of the deadline. Danny Jansen's off to a nice start there as well. They were an active team. Kind of decided to make it like an AL East day since we're coming off an Orioles series and about to play the Yankees. We'll sprinkle some Red Sox in too. Jay Chiriano is going to join us at 11. In addition to being a former Olympian for Canada basketball as a player and as a coach, and the former head coach of the Toronto Raptors and current assistant coach with the Sacramento Kings, he's also a massive Blue Jays fan who rarely misses a game, even with the NBA schedule. So we'll talk to him about baseball and, yeah, a little bit of Canada basketball. Canada-Spain at 11:15 today on CBC. Pretty big game. Actually, I think it's on Sportsnet, not CBC. I should double-check that. CBC. All right. And then we'll talk to Bob Lorenz of Yes Network. He does the pre and post game for the Yankees down in New York. We'll get you set up for this series. Marcus Stroman against Kevin Gausman tonight. We'll also answer some of your texts in the text line. You can fire those away to 590, 590. Standard message and data rates may apply. We'll sprinkle those in throughout the show. So hit us up, 590, 590. You like the deadline? What are you most curious about the rest of the way here? Prospect questions, waiver wire, DFA reliever questions, whatever you got for us. Hit us up, 590, 590. We'll take a break. Chris Cotillo joins us on the other side as JSTOC Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays in action against the Yankees, who are tied in at the top of the American League East. Not too far behind, chasing more of the wild card, but not entirely out of the division, are the Boston Red Sox, who were also quite active on deadline day, including acquiring old friend Danny Jansen, who's off to a nice little start there in Boston, where, he can spend the rest of his season playing ping pong with the Green Monster. Let's talk to Chris Cotillo of MassLive.com about that Red Sox deadline. Chris, how we doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Let's start with Danny Jansen. The Red Sox give up a couple of prospects there. You know, we don't always, you know, we don't need to get as specific necessarily as, oh no, Isak Paredes is never going to hit a home run again because he changed ballparks. But you have to think at first blush, Danny Jansen is going to be a pretty good fit in Fenway.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. You know, they want him to pepper the ball off the Green Monster. They want him to, maybe hit some pull side homers. It's a guy that they've liked and been high on for a while. A guy that, you know, they feel like has done pretty well at Fenway throughout his career. I think if you look at the game logs, he's only hit like 190 there as a member of the Jays, but there has been, you know, four or five homers. He hit the ball very hard against Alex Cora's team for a couple of seasons, and, you know, they saw it from afar. And I think also they were just, you know, they were comfortable getting a catcher midseason, which is not always a guaranteed easy transition, because they thought that this is a guy who has been in the division for so long and has at least a little familiarity with the arsenals and the repertoires of guys like Tanner Houck, Cutter Crawford, Nick Pivetta from game planning for them offensively. So, you know, I think an outside the box move for the Red Sox to get a right-handed bat. But as you said, so far so good. You know, a couple of big hits the other day and a big win against Seattle. And a guy that they feel like can fit in for the last couple months. One that I think caught us off guard as a, you know, marginal upgrade over Reese McGuire. I think he took McGuire's job in Toronto before, but one that it transpired, and he was actually, you know, their only offensive addition. Everybody else they got were pitchers at the deadline. So they do, I guess, have expectations for him.
Yeah, it seems like it. And I mean, I was a little surprised too. I mean, the fit is good from a ballpark and hitting style perspective, but I'm with you. I like them being one of the teams targeting a catcher caught me a little off guard given the season that Connor Wong's had. And I think, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, it still seems like Connor Wong will have the lion's share of the playing time there at catcher. But the fact that the Red Sox have even talked about playing Connor Wong at second base a little bit more. I know he's bounced first, second, third in the past for like a couple innings here and there, but never started a game at the major league level anywhere but catcher. What did you make of that comment? How realistic do you think it is that, we could see Connor Wong so they can get two catchers in there without using the DH spot?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a lot about bench balance. You know, they've had all season, you know, struggles hitting against lefties. Jansen hasn't been a lefty masher this season, but, you know, Masataka Yoshida's hit 160 against lefties. He's been really good against righties lately in the DH spot. You know, you've seen, you know, Devers is not horrible against lefties, but not as good as, you know, he is against righties, obviously, and some other holes in the lineup. At first base, they have Dom Smith playing. The second base, you know, David Hamilton has not hit lefties at all. They tried calling up a guy, Jamie Westbrook, 11-year minor leaguer. He kind of proved that he's not, you know, cut out for the majors, or trying a new guy, Nick Sogard, who would make his major league debut when he debuts. So they're trying a lot of different things to try to jumpstart the offense. You know, Romy Gonzalez, another guy that tried to put in there. And this is just another way to try to get more right-handed bats in the lineup. I think against lefties, you could see, you know, Jansen DHing, Wong catching, vice versa. I think on some certain days, you know, if they want Yoshida's bat in the lineup, they could put Wong at second. I don't think he's going to be starting there a lot, but you know, a few times down the stretch, you know, they tried this last year in the second half, putting Justin Turner at second base for a handful of games. I'm, you know, not 100% in tune with the day-to-day of the Blue Jays, but I'm going to guess that in the 4 months he was there, I'm going to guess and hope for Blue Jays fans that he didn't play any innings at second base, because You know, it's not an easy ask for a guy who's like 40 and has not played there for a while and is kind of perpetually banged up because of how hard he plays. But, you know, they tried just from an offensive perspective, could sacrifice some defense. They think Wong's athleticism could play there. As you said, it's only been a couple innings here and there in the field over the last couple of years. I don't think it's going to be a long-term thing, but, you know, just another option if the offense is stalling. And we've seen that, you know, coming out of the All-Star break on a West Coast trip, they got shut down by James Paxton, who, you know, then got traded to them. They got shut down by, you know, guys like Austin Gomber in Colorado and some of these, you know, lefties that are not the Clayton Kershaws of the world, shut them down. It's just because when you have your best hitters across the board, you know, Devers, as I said, Yoshida, some of these guys are lefties, Duran, you know, lefties have been carving them up. I think they're like 12 and 19 against them when lefties start. And for that's kind of a glaring hole. We all thought they'd go out and get a guy who's a traditional lefty masher. I think the prices were a little bit high and they ended up with Jansen instead.
Yeah, I had wondered at one point, would they go after a Justin Turner because he still has good numbers against lefties this season? He obviously goes to Seattle. And no, we did not see him at second base. And when we saw him at third base, the team then decided Vladimir Guerrero Jr. was going to play third base a little bit for the first time since 2019. So that can give you an idea of the defensive spectrum there for Turner. That's a lot of great stuff on Danny Jansen and that kind of flexibility it adds for the Red Sox. What did you make of the price point on the Danny Jansen rental here? I know you're a guy who keeps an eye on the system pretty closely. You and I had actually talked about Cutter Coffey last time you were here in Toronto because he was right in the middle of that six-game homer streak that was going on. So Edinson, Paulinho, Cutter Coffey, Gilberto Batista, that being the price tag for 2 months and the playoffs of Danny Jansen here, what did you make of that side of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good deal for the Blue Jays just because there is upside with those players, you know, and they ended up getting three of them. You know, the Red Sox and Jays talked about a lot of different things at the deadline. They got pretty close on another deal that same day. Nate Pearson obviously went to the Cubs. The Red Sox really thought they had him. The name we heard going the other way was Emmanuel Valdez, who's a guy that's been in the majors a lot. Kind of a one-dimensional player, you know, a lefty who can hit righties and hit for power. But is not a good fielder, definitely can't hit lefties, and, you know, defensively very limited at second. So if I'm the Jays, I like this return a lot better, even though these guys have not, you know, been in the majors. I look a lot at pedigree, you know, still. You know, we see that time and time again. That's why people and teams, you know, Pearson obviously has never panned out to be the superstar that people thought he was, but, you know, he's still that guy. He was a first-round pick. I think the same kind of thing in a lesser extent can be said about Coffey. You know, he's only 20. 2 years ago out of high school, he's a 41st overall pick. He signs for almost $2 million as a bonus. You know, that's to me something that, you know, when a guy's drafted that high and gets that much money, there's obviously talent there. Is he the top prospect in the system? No. But, you know, in a Red Sox system full of infielders, I think other teams were able to capitalize. They had to give up, you know, four guys for Luis Garcia from the Angels, three guys for Jansen. So I think, you know, everybody that saw the return probably thinks that, you know, it's a little bit heavy for Jansen, considering the stat line, considering, you know, he's a complimentary piece on the Red Sox. But where the system was, you know, they were in a comfortable place giving up some of these middling infielders who are way behind a lot of the other guys in their system, and they're behind, you know, some of the best prospects in baseball. Marcelo Meyer, everybody knows, should have a stranglehold on the shortstop position for years to come. We've seen in the majors this year, you know, Rafael has played shortstop really well, moving back and forth from short to center. David Hamilton has been, you know, struggling lately. Last time we were in Toronto, he was like the hottest hitter in baseball as a middle infielder. Vaughn Grissom's a guy that people have forgotten about, you know, acquired for sale and still in the system at second. And they have Trevor Story under contract for three more years, assuming he's healthy. So, you know, there's a few guys. That's why they traded, you know, Nick York, who's a former first-round pick. That's why they traded Matthew Lugo, who's in AAA, knocking on the door. And that's, I think, you know, partly why they traded, you know, Coffey, why they were comfortable trading Paulinho, who's probably the best of the group. If you look at it, you know, that's, I just outlined the middle infield, and on the corners they have Devers and Casas for, you know, five, six more years each. So if you're an infield prospect in the Red Sox system, either, you know, learn how to pitch or you might get traded.
Yeah, or learn left field or something like that. You know, every prospect in the Blue Jays system plays some left field now as well, just in case. So, and they certainly don't have a Rafael Devers filling third base. I should mention, because you mentioned Nate Pearson, and I picked on him a little bit after his Cubs debut where he gave up a monster home run and then hit a batter and got ejected. He had a very nice outing last night, got the win over two innings with the Cubs. So, yeah, nice to see Nate Pearson having some success there. So with respect to the Sox system, like, that's a good outline of why these specific players, they also dealt like 8 or 9 or 10 prospects for Jansen and Garcia and Sims and Paxton and Priester. And obviously those things helped the major league level. This is still a farm system that you look at the rankings, you look at Fangraphs, farm value, whatever, still comfortably a top 10 system. I guess this is kind of just like, you know, you're able to be a little bit more aggressive with these moves too if you've done a really good job maintaining a deep system. Like, it doesn't, like, if Cutter Coffee becomes something, it probably doesn't hurt you as much as if Cutter Coffee is like the cream of your prospect crop, right? Like, it just, to me, it just kind of highlights, even though the Red Sox haven't had, you know, Red Sox level success at the major league level the last couple of years, they have done a really good job down on the farm.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like, we can look back to just another, you know, trade with the Blue Jays to show, you know, how you should probably operate at this time of year. In 2018, those Red Sox were about a billion times better than these Red Sox. They had about 100% playoff odds. They obviously won 108 games in the World Series. They needed a right-handed bat. They got Steve Pierce.
That's right.
They gave up Espinal, who was by no, you know, stretch a top prospect in the system. And he ended up, you know, I know it's not like he was a world beater, but he was an all-star one year, right? He was a good player for the Jays for a little while.
He was DHing for the Reds the other night, which is a wild use of Santiago Espinal, right. But
like, that's the type of guy that, you know, he was blocked in the system. They had other guys coming up. They wanted to push for the playoffs. They identified the weakness of hitting lefties, which, you know, they, Steve Pierce did better than almost anybody. And, you know, they won a World Series, Steve Pierce with the World Series MVP. No one's going to care that, you know, Espinal, even on a division rival, is a major leaguer and a major leaguer for a few years. And so I think, you know, Craig Breslow looked at this and said, you know, there are 10 guys that they traded. None of them, you know, SoxProspects.com around here is kind of the, you know, most up to date gold standard list. The top guy they traded was number 12 in York, then number 13 in Lugo. Paulino was 15th, and then, you know, Coffey was in the 20s. They preserved their top 10 prospects, and that includes really the big four of, you know, Anthony, Marcelo Meyer, Teal, and Christian Campbell, a guy who's like hitting 400 for an extended stretch at Double A and has been excellent. So I think it kind of made sense for the Red Sox to do it this way, where, you know, they were not going to give up their absolute blue chippers for a team that does not deserve that type of investment. You know, this is a team that's hovered around the wild card race all year. Have they exceeded expectations? Yes. Have they been up and down? Yep. I mean, see what they've done out of the All-Star break. They won their, you know, won their first series after the break just this week, and they lost the first three, including to a bad team in Colorado. So I don't think this is the team you want to go all in on. And so the fact that they were able to, you know, kind of package deals, you know, fantasy football is on my mind already this time of year. I think it's kind of like when you package, you know, try to package like 3 or 4 of your bench players to try to get somebody else's player when you have the depth and they don't, you know, and those trades get denied in the fantasy football level. But they traded 4 prospects for Luis Garcia. They traded 3 for Jansen. You know, that's 7 prospects for 2 rentals. I think they're willing to be okay with the fact that one of those 7, you know, is probably going to be a good big leaguer, just not here.
Yeah, and if things work out well for you, like, who cares, right? Like you said with the Steve Pierce, like, you obviously care, but also, like, there is an element, too, of, like, it tells you something about your talent identification and player development and probably for your trade reputation if guys you trade away have some success. You don't want them to, you don't want to trade Dansby Swanson for Shelby Miller, but, like, it's okay if Santiago Espinal has a 5-year major league career because Steve Pierce helped you in a really important time. Like, you can do the win-win thing. So,
and if you look back at that 2018 deadline, like, they traded Jalen Beeks to the Rays. He ended up being a good major leaguer. Espinal, and then Ty Buttrey to the Angels for Ian Kinsler. He ended up being a good major leaguer for like a year or two, and then he quit baseball. But that aside, like, that Red Sox fans, you know, it's not like they're going to look at those guys and wish they were there when the confetti is falling. So
yeah, even if the confetti doesn't fall, like,
Right.
The fact that Jeff Hoffman is a really good reliever for the Phillies, I'm not turning around and being like, oh, I want my 3 years with Troy Tulowitzki back, where the Jays went to the ALCS a couple times.
Exactly.
So with the way things shake out here for the Red Sox, I know there is a little bit of a question about the health of Kenley Jensen right now and his back. Obviously, Lucas Sims and Luis Garcia help with that. If Kenley Jensen is healthy, those guys kind of slot in as like eighth inning plus leverage guys. How do you feel about where the Red Sox bullpen is today versus a week ago?
Yeah, and their biggest additions or reinforcements are still to come. Chris Martin and Justin Slayton are on the injured list and due back relatively soon. You know, Chris Martin has had a very uneven, inconsistent year. You know, he's been on the IL twice already. Anxiety for the first time, and then elbow inflammation here recently. Had a bad April dealing with a left shoulder thing, was excellent in May, and then once the anxiety stuff surfaced, you know, he's been kind of inconsistent. Obviously, you know, the kudos to him for speaking up about that. This time it's an elbow. Justin Slayton, a Rule 5 pick rookie, who was one of the most important and valuable relievers in baseball in this first half in terms of WAR, going multi-innings, high leverage situations, really, really good. And so when those guys come back, you have those guys, you have a guy in Zach Kelly who's really stepped up. You know, they like Josh Winkowski's arm still. They have, you know, Brandon Bernardino, who's been a dominant lefty really for the 2 years he's been up. And then you have Sims and Garcia. It's a really, really deep group. They move Cooper Criswell to the bullpen. He's on a 10-inning scoreless streak, including a 7-inning scoreless start in Colorado, which is not easy to do. They moved him to the bullpen as the long man in place of Chase Anderson, who they said goodbye to. I think the bullpen's a deep group. You know, they have a lot of different weapons, a lot of different guys that can attack you in different ways. I think Andrew Bailey in that group is excited to get guys in the lab, whether it be Sims or Garcia, see what they have, make some tweaks, tinker with them. You know, they identified that as a clear area of need, and their bullpen had an ERA around 7 in July. So it was pressing, it was urgent. And I think it just lengthens the group to me. You know, with Slayton and Martin coming back, if I'm the Red Sox, I'd rather do, you know, 6th inning, 7th inning guy you don't have to pay a ton for, like Garcia, like Sims, instead of, you know, you mortgage your whole farm for Scott or Adam or some of these guys, Estevez, that we saw move that would have cost you a lot more. Now, Alex Cora said the other day, for the top rental relievers, teams were asking for Meyer and Anthony and those, you know, top 100 prospect types. And that makes absolutely no sense, obviously. And I think, you know, they were able to get Sims for a 19-year-old, pretty good pitcher, but someone who's years away. And then Garcia, like I said, for that package of four kind of depth pieces headlined by their number 13 prospect. So I think good business. The sexiest moves, no, but, you know, ones that I think made sense for what they're trying to do.
Sexy isn't everything, Chris. You know, you can be smart as well. Red Sox in action against the Rangers this weekend. Then they got the Royals. Yeah, big time for them to make this wild card push. Appreciate you taking some time out to chat with us, man.
Of course, anytime. Thanks.
Chris Cotillo of MassLive.com. A lot of good stuff there on the prospects the Red Sox gave up to the Toronto Blue Jays, as well as to other teams around the league. Yeah, they really fortified that bullpen. And then first time Kenley Jansen comes out since then, it's like, oh, good thing you fortified the bullpen. Now, there are two games back of that wild card, that final wild card spot. The American League wildcard race is going to be interesting here because Baltimore and the Yankees are tied atop the American League East. And obviously, whichever of those teams does not win the American League East is comfortable in the wild card spot. They're four games up. Kansas City is still hanging on here. They've got the second wild card. They're half game up on Minnesota, who are two games up on Boston. Seattle is mostly competing for the AL West, but they're on the periphery of the wild card. And then Tampa Bay's kind of there, but obviously they sold at the deadline. So it's still a competitive wild card race. There are still some teams close. But when we look back to a couple weeks ago when we were talking about who could be buyers and sellers at the deadline, the Rangers and Tigers were both closer. The Jays, we already knew they'd sell, but they were a little bit closer. And depending on how you feel about the Rays, who are 4.5 back now and sold off, you know, this might be down to four teams competing for two spots. So if you're a team like the Red Sox, you know, one of the things you have to factor in when you're talking about your wild card chances is not just how many games out you are, but how many teams you're fighting with, how many teams you have to be better with down the stretch. Boston's probably looking, it's like, okay, Minnesota, Kansas City, Seattle, we got to be better than those teams. But like, the Rangers are 8 games behind now. The Tigers are 8.5 behind. There's some clarity there. Where on the National League side, it's still a big old mess, and you know, half the league is still within five games of a playoff spot. We'll probably talk about that more next week at the lay of the land in the NL. We'll probably, this show is going to be like at least a little bit more of an MLB wide show now that the Blue Jays are where they are here in August. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk Blue Jays. We're also going to talk some Canada basketball. Canada with a big game at 11:15 today against Spain. Jay Triano, former Olympian as a player, former Olympian as a coach on the basketball side, and a huge Blue Jays fan, joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ben Ennis.
And I'm Brent Gunning.
We got you covered on all things Leafs, Raptors, and Blue Jays every weekday morning, 6 to 9.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. No Jays action yesterday. Jays action tonight. They're playing the Yankees. We also got some Canada basketball action coming up. The Canadian men 2-0 to start. Big game against Spain coming up here. Canada, the men have already qualified for the knockout stage. They'll make it on to the quarterfinals no matter what. But today could be big because it'll determine where they finish in their pool, as well as determining which of their pool compatriots can move on. Also important for seeding because FIBA reseeds the quarterfinals. It's not an automatic, this team goes here, this team goes there. It's based on record and plus minus, and then they adjust to make sure group teams from the same group can't play each other again. So the goal today is, you know, not only beat Spain, but hopefully beat Spain by more than the point differential that you need if and when France beats Germany or Germany beats France. And that basically the goal is to avoid the United States as long as possible. And while that can sound like, you know, scared money don't make money or whatever, we got to be realistic about what the Olympic field looks like and how good that United States team is. You would, of course, prefer, even if you can beat them, you would prefer to put that off until the finals if you can, rather than the semifinals or the quarterfinals. So big game today. Canada has already made it on, by the way. This is the first time that they have made it out of the group stage since back when our next guest was a part of the program. It's Sacramento Kings assistant coach and former head coach of Team Canada at the Olympics, former player on Team Canada at the Olympics, former Raptors head coach. It's Jay Triano. Jay, good morning, man. Thank you for doing this. How are we doing?
My pleasure. My pleasure. We're doing great, man. Excited to watch this game.
Yeah. How are you feeling about how it's gone so far? I mean, obviously 2-0 and some things to work on, but in a pretty good spot, relatively speaking.
I agree. I think off to a good start. I mean, these tournaments, you gotta remember, it's over a two-week period, and you do not want to be at your best in that first week and have things tail off. You want to slowly build, and I think, you know, after the first two games, we're in pretty good position. Today's game is going to be a real test. I mean, Spain is going to be super hungry. They're either going to advance or they're going to go home with a loss. So we're going to face a very, very hungry team and a team that has been traditionally very good in the international game.
So when you look at Canada's side of this, obviously a huge game for Spain. I laid out some of the kind of the way the quarterfinals are set up. In your experience, and you have coached and played at this level, are you aware of those things? Are you working through those things? Or does the focus just need to be, hey, we got to win and we got to play our best game and those things will land where they land?
Yeah, I don't think you can get caught looking outside of what you can control. At the same time, you know, we're in a great position where we can control our own fate. Over the years, the international game, sometimes you sit back and you're thinking, oh, how we would like this team to win or we would like this team to lose. But, you know, if you take care of your own business, then that puts you in a good spot. A win today by a good number would put us in a great position to be one of the top two seeds. But, you know, if we just squeak by, it's probably going to be the United States and Germany in those top two spots if Germany can win. So it's, you know what, you don't get caught looking at anything. You want to be playing your best basketball. You don't want to try to manipulate matchups and who you might be playing against. Just get better as a team yourself.
So that Germany team, by the way, it's a tough one because it's probably better for Canada if France wins that game. But, you know, I don't really want to root for France. And I with Germany, you know, not only Dennis Schroeder was a Raptor this year and is a fun FIBA player, but they're coached by a Canadian in Gordy Hubert, who you played with in the Olympics. Do you find yourself, like, maybe today aside, but, like, wanting Germany to do good because of the Gordy connection there?
Oh, for sure. I think, you know, there was a lot of happiness last year when Gordy was with that team and they won the world championships. And he's a very, very good coach. And, I agree. I don't want to be cheering for that home country right now. I don't think you don't want them getting on a roll at home. And although I think we will do well against them, but you just don't want to put yourself in that position because, you know, they're very, very, it's a team that if we do match up with them eventually, it's a tough matchup just because of their length. I mean, they've got great length and we would have to really spread them out. I think Jordy's done a great job of spreading teams out just because of our size right now.
By the way, a small update on this one from our pal Dan Schulman. Santi Aldama and Rudy Fernandez, who are both questionable for this game, are both out on the court warming up for Spain. So two big pieces for them there. Jay, so Dan was the one who first tipped me off. Like, I knew you were a Jays fan. I didn't know how big a Jays fan you are until Dan kind of filled me in. Can you tell me a little bit about that fandom? I'm always so fascinated by when someone's, you know, your life has been very basketball heavy, when they also have the space to, hey, I'm a fan of this sport as well.
Well, I think it's just growing up as a kid in Niagara Falls. My dad would sit in the garage just because there was a piece of fresh air that would blow through the front and back door. And when he would do that, we would listen to the Blue Jays games all the time. And then, of course, they win a championship. It was a big deal to go from Niagara Falls into Toronto to watch games. So I just kept following it. And then as an NBA coach, it's my downtime. So in the off season, I just love to go out, watch the games. I lived right at Maple Leaf Square. I would look out if the dorm was open, I'd walk down and get a ticket and sit up in 500 level watch games. So I've been a fan for a long time. I played baseball. I won a Canadian championship as a 16-year-old coming out of in Niagara Falls. So I played baseball. I'm a big baseball fan. I've always followed the Jays. And then I'll try to hit them on the road when they come out here on their Western swings.
Man, a Canadian championship at 16. What can't this guy do? So with that fandom, like, baseball and basketball are nice. Like, I do both sports. And there's a tiny bit of overlap if the teams do well. The Blue Jays are not doing that well right now, so we don't have to worry about that overlap this year. But keeping up with the team, you know, do you find it like pretty manageable given even with the 162 games because of the offseason basketball schedule and only those small windows of overlap there?
Yeah, especially in the last couple of years, I've really found it just because, you know, I'll finish at the arena and I'll come home at 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock on the West Coast is 7 o'clock. You know, I'll have the game on during dinner, and you know, I'll watch more games now that I'm on the West Coast than any other time. And you know, you're right. The seasons are pretty much, for the most part, they're opposite. But I'll have Jays games on in my office at work as well if it does happen during the season. So yeah, I'd say I watch probably 80% of the games, if not more. Yeah, I just love it. It's a great release from the tension and the stress of the, you know, the game that I coach in right now. So it's just fun.
Do you find yourself thinking like a coach sometimes still, though, or are you able to kind of separate and be like, no, I'm a fan of this one. I don't need to put myself in the position of what would I do and things. I know part of baseball fandom is like questioning the manager decisions and stuff like that anyway. But are you able to turn the coach part of your brain off?
A little bit, but you know, but again, exactly. You know, I'll watch it for fun, but I'll be sitting there sometimes going, now, what would I do here? Why would I do this? Or I would sit back and be an armchair general manager for sure. But, you know, for the most part, I just turn it off and like to just watch it and enjoy the games.
So in terms of that armchair general manager, obviously the season has not gone particularly well. What was your opinion on how they handled the deadline here in a bad season?
Well, I think, you know, reloading is probably the right thing. I do like that we kept Vladdy. I mean, I just think that, you know, the way he's played, especially the second half of the year, you know, that's been super positive. So I like that we've kind of reloaded a little bit. The division that we're in is extremely tough, as everybody knows. So it makes it tough, but you know, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with looking towards the future. It's not like I'm sitting on the fence whether I'm going to be a fan in the future or not. I'm always going to be a fan, so I'm okay with the rebuild and looking towards what happens next.
Yeah, and it'll be, you know, the way it's rebuilt, they're probably going to try to be competitive again next year. If Vlad hits like this, that's a nice start for it. Look, obviously, you've been a fan of the team for a long time, so you've been a fan through lean years before. You said you probably catch 80% of the games. Will that dip off a little bit with the way the rest of the season looks now?
Not really. I mean, you know, being out here, I go to one of the pitchers for the Giants is from this area. So I follow the Giants. I just feel like I need to have a little bit of a National League team as well. So I like that their games come on later, so I'll sometimes have double headers, but I'll still watch the Jays. I'm loyal to the Jays, and you know, I'll stick with them right through the season and see how the new players actually fit in and how they start batting. I mean, batting was probably the biggest issue this year, and I think, you know, that's something we got to maybe address and figure out how we're going to hit better, especially with the new renovations. I mean, the renovations were supposed to help us, and they certainly haven't.
No, they haven't, and it's one of those weird things. Like, as a, you know, a more analytic guy, you can run the numbers or whatever, but you never know until you see how the ball flies and how the walls play and stuff like that. It's been a little surprising. I guess the Giants are, I mean, that ballpark is beautiful, first of all, but like, you also, they've got what, Matt Chapman, they got Robbie Ray, Jordan Hicks, like they've got a handful of ex Blue Jays there as well. So they're kind of like making it easier for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And our sports psychologist that works with the Kings during the year is the sports psychologist that works with the Giants. So I've been down when the Jays were there, is down on the field for batting practice and stuff like that. And, you know, we talk about that all the time. I say, you're getting a whole bunch of the ex-Jays that are coming over. you're getting good people. And, you know, the Giants, they've gone through their injuries, you know, Robbie Ray's injury and stuff. But, they, you know, he's starting to pitch again. And they're really positive about their future, especially with their starting rotation. Logan Webb is the guy that I've become friends with over the year. He pitched a complete game the other night, and you know, it's just fun. It's fun being able to follow him because he comes to most of the Kings games here in Sacramento as well.
Nice, and he is a very good pitcher, and like a bit of a throwback. Like, I think he threw like 215, 220 innings last year. So nice to have a small handful of those guys left around as well. Jay, I did want to pivot to the Kings just briefly. I know that you had a hand in when DeMar was first visiting there, and you obviously have a relationship going back with DeMar, and everyone here in Toronto still very much roots for DeMar. What was that like? How excited are you to be paired back up with him?
I'm very excited. I mean, you know, we have an excellent point guard in De'Aaron Fox and a strong center who's a great distributor and Sabonis. We just needed a little bit of help on the wing, and DeMar is the ultimate wing player. So I'm excited for it. I think that he's going to give us the scoring late in games, the ability to get to the free throw line. Analytically, we did not get to the line as much as we should have last year. He will help with that. Just seeing him, he said, I remember when I was a rookie, I was scared to death being in Toronto, and you were my first coach, and you pulled me out of a game, and you yelled at me, and you told me to shoot the ball. I don't care if you miss. And he goes, I've kept that with me my whole career. And I said, well, you're going to hear it again, because, you know, I'm big on shooting it, putting it up there. There's better chance for us to go and get a rebound than if we hang on to it and don't take a shot and end up turning the ball over. So, yeah, we had a good chuckle about that. I was part of the recruiting process, obviously, and super happy to have him here, you know, to hopefully finish out his career and go on a bit of a run in the Western Conference here.
Yeah, it's pretty good advice to tell DeMar DeRozan to just shoot him more. Like, this is a guy who's going to finish his career probably in the top 20 in scoring all the time. So, yeah, sure. Hopefully he continues to give you credit for that one. The game's about to start here, so last one before I let you go. You also have in Sacramento Trey Lyles, who's a part of this Canada team. How excited were you to see him get back to being a part of the national program and what we've seen from him here with Canada?
Yeah, well, I think Trey gives you the opportunity to stretch the floor because he can play small ball and put him at the five at times. We do that with him in Sacramento here. His relationship with Jordy was really, really important because they talked a lot throughout the year. And I talked to Trey. I said, you can be an NBA player for a long, long time. You can only be an Olympian maybe once or twice in your life. I know it's a huge sacrifice, but you got to do it for your country. And he was all on board and got excited about it. And he's super happy to be there.
Well, it's a lot of fun. This one should be a lot of fun. Your guy, Jordy, handling things. A pretty nice start here, 2-0. I know you got to lock in for this one, Jay, so I'll let you go. Thanks so much for taking the time out.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you, Blake.
Jay Triano, a two-time Olympic basketball player for Canada, one-time Olympic basketball coach for Canada, former head coach of the Raptors, of course, and currently an assistant with the Kings. And the man knows his baseball. The man knows his Toronto Blue Jays. Yeah, Canada, that game is on CBC momentarily here. And again, I know this is a baseball show, but it's the Olympics. It's a pretty big Canada game. I got my Shea and Dort shirt on, and there's a Canada jersey over there. We're going to talk. I mean, we did this last year during the World Cup, too. It's not as if the outcome of tonight's Jays game is all that important for the Toronto Blue Jays, although we will continue throughout the show to tee that series up. It's Kevin Gausman, Marcus Stroman tonight. We're going to take a break in a minute here, and then we'll talk to Bob Lorenz of the Yes Network to get the Yankees' perspective here.
Did want to touch on a couple of texts in the text line. You can continue to fire those our way to 590, 590. Standard data and message rates may apply. Some good ones in there. Phil in Hamilton asked, what's Addison Barger's best position? That is a fascinating question, and part of the reason I asked Ben Shulman earlier what position he sees Addison Barger playing more down the stretch is because I think we need to figure that out. Like, I think, you know, unless Addison Barger starts hitting a lot better, like his near term is as like near term being 2025 is probably as a bench piece where the positional versatility is helpful. You know, I think you'd probably want to get more of a look at him in left. The arm plays better in right because he has by far the best arm on the team, probably the best arm in the entire system. But he has not shown to be particularly adept at right field yet from a range and tracking perspective. Now, having said that, he's played 23 games in right field in his career and only 16 of those were starts. Like, we're talking about between AAA and the majors, he's played like 140 innings in right field. So possible he could get better at that. Left field, there is a little bit less of a learning curve. It's the same side of the diamond that he's used to. So I remember when I talked to Spencer Horwitz about learning second base, he had been trying some left field as well and told me that second base is actually, even though it's a quick twitch position, you got to react a little quicker on the infield. Coming from first base, all the angles are the same. The way you shade, the way the ball comes off the bat and things like that, how you read the ball is similar. So I'd wonder if for Barger, having played so much shortstop and third base, if left field is a more natural spot for him to pick up the ball. I still think versatility-wise, you probably want to get him reps at third base. You want to see, you know, can he stick at that position? Is it going to be too much? The arm is obviously plus. But yeah, realistically, I think he's probably a left fielder who can spot in at third and right if you need him in a pinch. I mean, he was starting at shortstop in AAA this year. So you can bounce him around everywhere, really. It'll be interesting to see where they slot him the rest of the way. My guess is he plays a little bit more third base because they're probably going to play Loperfido every day against righties, and he would man left field in that case. But we'll see how it goes. Jordan in Vancouver asked, would I give Vladdy a run at third this year to see if he's capable of doing that full time? I mean, it wouldn't be to see if he's capable of it. It would be because it's fun. They're not going to go into next year with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. as a third baseman on paper. Like, they're just like, it is something that I'm cool with them doing, and they're doing because the versatility is helpful. And if it comes up one game a week where, you know, let's say you go out and sign a third baseman and he's older, so he's only playing five games a week, or he gets hurt or whatever, or it's a lefty who doesn't hit lefties well, so you want to do something different against lefties, it's nice to have that. You can't go into next year with like Vlad as your third baseman. There's a reason you pivoted off of that in 2019. Even if he's not bad there, he's a first baseman slash DH. Like, when he was a third baseman in 2019, he was statistically, as far as we can measure these things, the worst third baseman in baseball. It's fun. I think he has good instincts there. He obviously has a great arm. He makes some fun plays. It's cool as a backup or once or twice a week option. But no, I don't think you're doing it with the eye toward, hey, Vlad's a third baseman now. There's also, this is getting too cute with it, but also third baseman costs more than first baseman. And if you think Vlad's going to play first base long term, you want him to sign him to a first baseman contract, not a third baseman contract. Rafael Devers is an interesting comp where Devers and Vlad had very, very similar numbers through their age 25 season in terms of OPS and home runs and things like that. And Devers signed a 10-year, I think $325 million deal with the Red Sox, but Devers plays third base. And even if he's only going to stick there for a couple years, the difference between a third baseman and a first baseman, assuming they're both roughly capable, like, you're talking about a win a year in terms of wins above replacement or the value of that contract. It's a pretty big difference in how much you'd be willing to pay a third baseman on a 10-year deal versus a first baseman slash DH on a 10-year deal. So I don't think you want to lean too much into the Vlad at third as a full-time thing unless he is showing you that he's really good at it, which, again, in 2019, you moved away from that for a reason. It's fun. It's a fun just in case, is I think the best way to put it. Steve in Calgary asks, so is Alejandro Kirk the catcher next season? He's one of them. And they love the defense. They love the blocking and framing. The hit the hitting has come back around a little bit. I don't think the power is ever really going to, like, I think him hitting 14 home runs a couple years ago is going to look like an outlier in time. His OPS is only 626 on the year. It's been north of 700 since, I think, like the middle of June. So that's a positive. You can get away, if you have a really strong lineup, you can get away with a catcher who's a below average bat if they're really good defensively as a blocker framer. The Astros during their World Series time trotted out Martin Maldonado all the time, and he would hit, like, I don't know, like a .180 or something like that. You can get away with that, but it requires you to be very, very sure that that catcher is strong defensively. I think that's true with Alejandro Kirk outside of the running game. All the blocking and framing and calling the game stuff that we know about and we hear about from the team or can track publicly, he grades really, really well. The run game, less so, but that's probably a little bit more on the pitchers. Regardless, even if you like Alejandro Kirk a lot, even if you think he's going to OPS closer to 700 than 600 where he's OPS this year, you need another catcher in there. And I don't think I don't think it's a knock on Alejandro Kirk to say he probably shouldn't play more than like 110 games. And maybe the ideal split is something like 90-70, like him and Danny Jansen were. They were about 50-50, before the Danny Jansen trade there. We've seen when Kirk plays more, his offensive numbers go down. The wear and tear on a catcher is big. If you have a starting catcher and a backup catcher, if one of those guys get hurt, what you have then is two backup catchers who are playing every day. So you're definitely addressing the catcher position, and I would lean towards someone who you'd be comfortable with playing 70, even 80 games and carrying that split time role. I just don't think you're going down the line of 125-game Alejandro Kirk. I think it's too risky from an injury perspective and an offensive performance effect perspective. Tim and Trenton ask, confidence level, Yariel will do well as a starter next season. Reasonably confident. I think he's shown some good stuff here. Like, there's obviously a lot to work on. That last outing was bad. It's not the first time he's completely lost command of his pitches. It's worth remembering he didn't pitch at all professionally for like 18 months other than the World Baseball Classic, which again isn't professionally, but it's a professional level. He is a rookie in Major League Baseball. And even if you consider, you know, Japan and Cuba and the World Baseball Classic, like, hey, oh, he's not a true rookie. He's 27 and has experience. He's still coming off a completely lost year. So there are going to be some ups and downs there. You would like to see the walks come down. You would like to see him be a little bit more pitch efficient, stay in the zone a little bit more. The fastball's been pretty good, but, you know, some of the breaking stuff, you know, working on when to use it, you know, how sharply to break it off. I find him very entertaining with the different leg kicks and cadences and arm angles and stuff. I do wonder if after a whole season they look at some of that and want to streamline some of it. I think the rest of this year is about figuring that out, and we'll see Sunday. I think the nice thing about Yariel Rodriguez is even if he ends up not being a starter, he's on a reasonable contract for a medium leverage or multi-inning reliever guy. But I think, yeah, I think right now you're looking at it and hoping that he can be a starter next year. Between him and Bowden and Jake Bloss, you need at least one of those guys to be in your rotation, I think, because you only have three starters locked up, and Alec Manoah and Ricky Tiedemann and guys like that aren't going, like, if they even make it back at all next season, you know, Manoah, you're talking about midseason, Tiedemann, you're talking about late in the season, if at all they're on the radar. And I think you have to go into the season assuming they won't be, and if they join you, that's gravy there. So yeah, a lot to learn about Yariel and Bowden and Jake Bloss the rest of the way here. And I know some people are just out on the Bowden Francis starting experiment overall, and I think that's fine. I think he's better than he's shown this year, and if he's, you know, in a multi-inning relief role next year, that's a valuable use of Bowden Francis as well. But there's no reason you can't give it a shot the rest of the way here and see how it looks, see if he can build on, you know, hey, he was dominant in AAA when he went down and was starting there. And every time he's gone down there, he's been awesome. Throws the splitter more, throws the curveball more. They're really good pitches. Can you carry that over? Can you build on, hey, you didn't have the best start last game, but you were able to give us 5 2/3 innings, which is the longest start of your career. Can you build on those things? That's kind of what the rest of the season is about, not just for him, but for everyone. Mike in Moncton says, was Jordan Romano's struggles this season all injury related? It's definitely part of it. He had an elbow issue in spring training, was set down, got a late start. Probably, I don't know, I haven't asked him about this. I would imagine he probably rushed back because the season's starting and you didn't have a spring training and things like that. And then multiple times he went down with elbow soreness and then eventually needed that surgery. And even though it wasn't Tommy John, if your elbow is constantly sore, I would imagine it's pretty hard to pitch. Now, some of it, you know, you can get into location. Was he trying to do too much with, you know, moving his mound placement and things like that? Or was he bad? Was he struggling? And that's why he was doing those things. There's a little chicken or egg there. I think you need to keep in mind the possibility that, you know, coming back off of an injury, he's maybe not the Jordan Romano he was before, at least not right away. You know, you probably hope you can get him in a few games at the end of this year to get that comfort level under him and see. But yeah, I definitely think if you're looking at the six ERA or whatever, you know, at least some of that was the fact that he was pitching through a late start and pretty consistent elbow soreness. We'll take some more texts in the next block as well. You can send them to us to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. We're going to take a break right now, though. When we come back, we'll get the Yankees side of this series. We'll talk to Bob Lorenz, 18-time Emmy winner from the YES Network, from Yankees pre- and post-games. He joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's the Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays back in action tonight. They're down at Yankee Stadium this weekend. 7:05 tonight, 1:05 tomorrow, 1:35 on Sunday. Over on YES Network, pre- and post-game, will be our next guest. He is an 18-time Emmy Award winner at YES, and just last week, he was nominated for a New York Emmy for Sports Anchor. What a treat to be joined by Bob Lorenz. Bob, good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Blake. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Man, does it get old at any point when you're getting nominated and winning Emmys left and right?
No, I appreciate the nomination. I appreciate more of the ones where we get for sort of our team Emmy noms, which are for our pre- and post-game and specialty show coverage. Those are the best ones because that's everybody involved.
Yeah, it seems like it would be a lot of fun. A lot of fun this week, I'd imagine, breaking down all that trade deadline stuff on the pre- and post games. I know it was chaotic here. The Jays had a doubleheader mixed in and everything. How was the deadline for you guys in New York?
Yeah, we expected, I don't know if you remember 2 years ago, but when they traded Jordan Montgomery for Harris Bader of the Cardinals, like literally right at the 6 o'clock deadline. So we've always kind of been since then hyper aware of anything that might go on. So Jack Curry and I were actually on the air at 6 o'clock when the trade deadline hit. So he was checking his phone constantly, making, you know, looking for texts from anybody within the Yankees organization, like maybe they made a move, maybe they didn't. And it's always an intriguing time. I don't know, Blake, if you're like us, but right up until that trade deadline at 6 o'clock, you're checking your phone, you're checking Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it, and just see, you know, the latest from all of the baseball insiders who know everything that's happening. So it's a chaotic, like you said, but it's a fun time.
Yeah, it was a blast. So I was on our pregame show on deadline day as well. So the Jays played at 6:35 and the deadline's at 6. And I was coming on around like 6:15 or something to talk about the prospect haul the Jays got. And yeah, up until the second we go on air, you're waiting. You're like, okay, who did they get back for Kevin Kiermaier? We don't know yet. We know the trade happened. We don't know what. So it's a lot of fun. The Yankees, you know, made a couple of moves here. Jazz Chisholm being the big one. Fun personality, really fun player. And man, what a start he's off to with the Yankees here. What do you like about the Jazz Chisholm addition for the Yankees?
I mean, you see the energy, you see the enthusiasm he plays with, you see the fact that unselfishly he's like, yeah, I've never played third base, but I'll go play there. And I know it's been two games, but he's played it really well. So the fact that he has injected that kind of excitement, that's kind of what you want at the trade deadline, right? These guys get a change of scenery. You believe that when you bring them in, they're going to lift the team up a little bit, and the energy in the clubhouse and on the field, I think that's what he's done.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of fun. And I was going to ask you how the third base defense had looked, but sounds like so far, so good. Do you imagine, like, I don't know how much they would even give this away, but like, he's played there a couple times now. Is that going to be an everyday spot for him? Is that ideally, is that more of an emergency situation? What's the plan with him positionally?
Well, I think positionally they're going to keep him there. They'll give DJ LeMahieu a few reps there, probably against left-handed pitchers, that kind of thing. I mean, LeMahieu, for as lousy a season as he's had, just coming off a 6-run batted in game. So maybe he found something, who knows. But, you know, I think they've got to find a way to keep him in the lineup. They can give Glaber a day off and move him over to second base. They could probably actually use Chisholm in the outfield if they wanted to, though they're pretty stacked with outfielders right now. So, yeah, I mean, bottom line, I think they keep him at third base probably 4 to 5 days a week.
Which will be interesting to see. I mean, it's not unheard of. Mookie Betts was playing shortstop earlier in the year after not playing it for a long time. So it's fun. And obviously, you know, you add the talent and figure out all those pieces after if it's a talent the level of Jazz Chisholm. The Yankees also tweaked in the bullpen a little bit, added Eniel De Los Santos and Mark Leiter Jr., sent out Caleb Ferguson. Where do you figure Mark Leiter Jr. Slots in from them in terms of, you know, inning or leverage with the way that bullpen shapes up?
I mean, we've already seen him twice, and I think he is definitely no problem mid, but I think he's late game, given the fact that he has that kind of a splitter or fork ball that drops down. He's a big strikeout guy. You know, that's what they wanted, Blake. They needed some guys that weren't contact guys, that were, you know, big strikeout guys. That's what they got in De Los Santos and Leiter Jr. And he already, in the last game they played a couple days ago, he had a huge strikeout with the bases loaded and was fired up. But I think, again, that kind of energy and the ability to put batters away, that's going to be key for them. So he's definitely a late inning option and could probably even close the game on days that Clay Holmes isn't available.
Which will be interesting to see. Obviously, anytime you can get a guy who you'd trust in that leverage of spot, a big addition for a playoff push here. Were you surprised at all? But like, obviously, Jazz Chisholm's a big move, and Mark Leiter's a nice piece. Had you expected the Yankees to be maybe a little bit more active than that?
Well, I think so, but I think people are sometimes reticent to deal with the Yankees. And also, they didn't have as much trade capital in the minors as they normally have because of all the deals they made in the offseason to get Soto and Verdugo. I think that ultimately with the trades they made, they lost, I think it was 12 or 13 players and like 10 of them were pitchers. So some of that depth that they had wasn't there. And I think when they tried to match up with certain teams, teams always came knocking for either Jason Dominguez, who's totally off bounds, or Spencer Jones. And there were some reports that they might give him up in a certain trade, but it would have had to have been for a real stud, you know, probably a pitcher or a position player, that kind of thing. So I just don't think they had the trade capital to match up with some other teams. And I think they actually did, Blake, have Jack Flaherty, the Tigers, really kind of zeroed in. But they reportedly, according to Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic, they looked at the medicals and didn't like something about his back, so that deal was never made.
Yeah, that's an interesting one that came out there, and obviously the Dodgers, they're the team when it comes to being okay with risk at the pitcher position. So
yeah,
that's maybe a good fit there. Bob, turning the focus to this series ahead here, Yankees come in having won 5 in a row against Boston and Philly. They scored 46 runs over those 5 games, and they've got a 9-game stretch here. The Jays are pretty weak. The Angels are pretty weak. Texas, you know, defending champs, but certainly not playing at a defending champ level. When you look at the American League East, you look at how the Yankees have played this last week or so, how big a window is this 9-game homestand?
Yeah, Blake, I think it's massive. I mean, I think the way you're playing, you have to put the pedal to the metal and win, you know, go 7-2, you know, maybe, especially now the Orioles are starting to get on a little bit of a heater again, too. I think, you know, that what they just beat the Blue Jays. They swept them, I guess, 4 games. But they were down. Well, the Yankees were down, ironically. So it kind of kept the division close at the top. And now they go into the day tonight tied for the division lead. So, yeah, I think these games against the Jays and Angels and Rangers, I think you're absolutely right. Like, you got to make some hay right now and show that you're that consistent team that doesn't, you know, one day score 14 and the next day you're shut out. You know, you've got to be consistent up and down that lineup.
Yeah, which, you know, the up and down the lineup part is kind of the key part because we know two guys are really going to hit, right? Like Aaron Judge hitting 316 with 39 homers and 99 RBI. He's almost at 40 and 100 here on August 2nd, second to only Bobby Witt Jr. In wins above replacement. And then Juan Soto, who's hitting just ahead of him in the lineup, just behind him in things like OPS plus and wins above replacement and things like that. He's got 27 homers and is hitting over 300 too. Yeah. Can you remember ever seeing a 1-2 punch? And like in the history of baseball, especially the history of the Yankees, there have obviously been some very deadly lineups. But two guys hitting this well right. together back to back and hitting well at the same time, too. Can you remember a duo being on this level?
Never. No. I mean, you know, you can go back to, I mean, for as long as they've lasted this season so consistently. I mean, you go to some of those tandems like, you know, Big Poppy and Manny Ramirez, when you think of teams with Boston. But just know, I mean, they're literally on an historic pace. Like, we keep showing these graphics, Blake, where it's like, oh, they're doing the same thing that Ruth and Gary did. Oh, they're doing the same thing that Ruth and Gary, like, legendary type stuff. And they're accomplishing it, like, every night and every week. It's amazing.
It's pretty incredible. And obviously, you know, one of the questions has been, can the Yankees hit up and down the order? Can they give them enough protection? But Giancarlo Stanton's back, Jazz Chisholm's in there now. How do you feel? How do they feel right now about their ability? I mean, Soto and Judge protect each other. You can't pitch around both of them
right.
all the time.
Right.
But the ability of that lineup to kind of support and supplement, make sure guys are on base for them and pitchers can't pitch around them entirely. What is the comfort level that the Yankees have enough outside of those two right now?
Well, I think they probably need to see it more now for, let's say, a week straight, like right over this 9-game span, right? Like, let's see what we just saw the past few days over this 9-game span to know we're back. Like, what we saw over the last 2 days was what they did over those first 70 games when they felt like they were just going to run away with the division. And then they had that backslide where I think they, you know, went 10-22 or whatever it was and kind of came back to the pack because they weren't hitting up and down the line. If it was just Soto and or Judge, and that was about it. But now you've got Stanton, who can put the ball in play this year and is hitting the fastball well. And you've got Chisholm right behind him. You got Glaber swinging a hotter bat. And so, and again, even if it's a fluke or maybe he's found something, DJ LeMahieu coming up with 6 runs batted in. When you have that kind of production, but then you could put it out there every night and know and have the confidence you're going to do it, I mean, that's a game changer. That's what they're hoping for.
Yeah, it's and then obviously there's always the case with Giancarlo, like even when the numbers aren't that good, he's terrifying, right? Like he just hits the ball. I think he had 120 mile an hour single or something like that the other day. Always scary there. On the Jays side of this, Bob, obviously this is not a particularly strong Jays team. They just sold a lot. From your perspective, what's the prep like for a team that just turned over a third of their roster last week?
Yeah, I think opportunity knocks for a lot of those guys.
Yeah.
And I think it almost becomes that Davey versus Goliath. Like, well, it's the Yankees. Everybody thinks we're going to lose. So let's just go out and throw our gloves on the field and make it happen. Let's just, you know, play like our hair's on fire and see if we can win 2 or 3, or we can do something to disrupt what the Yankees are doing. I mean, we see that all the time. Teams wanting to be disruptors down the stretch. Maybe they don't have a shot. And you look at some of the young talent the Blue Jays got, and why not? Why not keep trying to just win games? And if nothing else, if it doesn't get you into the playoffs or even into the wild card conversation, at least some of these young guys are making a case for, hey, I want to be here for 2025 and beyond.
Yeah, and that's a great point about the, you know, not only that guys have a lot to play for, and hey, individually, if a lot of hitters are playing well, your team's going to play okay, even if you're not a great team overall necessarily. But that element of, yeah, there's nothing to lose, right, is a real factor here. So, Bob, we're going to see Marcus Stroman and Carlos Rodon in the first 2 games of this one. The third one's a TBD. Last I saw, Garrett Cole was expected to throw a bullpen today, and that'll kind of determine what they're doing Sunday. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think he's going to be the guy. So he's coming off late that they called it general body fatigue, and everybody was tying it to like, oh, his last start, and he kind of alluded to that. But he also, according to the team and himself, had some kind of bug, like let's say it's a flu or a cold. And I think that's what kind of knocked him down and caused that body fatigue. And I was surprised that didn't get more attention, like, oh, you had this bug, that probably weakened you a little bit too. Like everybody was tying it to, oh, is he healthy? Is there something wrong with the arm? And it's like, no, there's nothing wrong with the arm. He's fine. It's just he needs to. He said he wanted to pitch with a full tank of gas, and he didn't feel like he had that. So, you know, you give him the antibiotics, you give him whatever to get him back, get that bug out of his system. He probably should be back up to full speed on Sunday. Again, it's TBD, but that would seem to be the plan.
Yeah, and that'll be, I mean, it means worse chances for the Blue Jays to win, but it's more fun if we get to watch Garrett Cole. No disrespect to Will Warren and his major league debut the other day. Bob, last one for you before I let you go here. Carlos Rodon, last time we saw him, he gave up 8 runs, but that was that start where he was able to at least give the Yankees 5 innings. And the Yankees talked about thinking that that was maybe something to build on, that he was able to give them length even on a day that he didn't have it. Since then, he's pitched a little better than he had been. He's had 3 pretty good ones in a row, strikeouts back up. What are you seeing with Carlos Rodon over the last few here?
You know what, Blake? It's weird when he goes into a funk. It's and again, this sounds like it's going into the weeds on it, but he almost gets out of whack with it, seeing his catcher with pitch sequencing. Like sometimes he'll have an outing where he'll just rely on the fastball and the slider, and it's like at a few changes and he's good. And then they realize the next start against a different team, like I really got to go to the changeup a lot more, which he doesn't love to do, but he will do it now. That's how he's kind of evolving as a pitcher, because he just used to be fastball slider. But it's when they figure it out. And I think sometimes they don't figure it out. And I think sometimes they do figure it out. Right now, it seems like they're in a groove where they figured out when fastball, when slider, when changeup, and that seems to be working out really well for him right now. So hopefully he can continue that.
Well, yeah, we'll see it. And the Jays, yeah, weirdly a little lefty heavy now with after some of the moves and some of the new guys here. So we'll see how they handle that on Saturday. Yeah. Bob, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. Have a great series.
Absolutely. Thanks, Blake. Appreciate the time.
Bob Lorenz of the Yes Network, Yankees pre and post games. And yeah, this guy's got more Emmys than, I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that one, but he is a very decorated guy because he's great. He is, the Yes Network does a lot of good stuff. Their pre and post games are a lot of fun. And they put a lot of it online too. So when you're prepping for a Yankees series, you can learn a lot real quickly. Not that we're out of the loop on the Yankees or anything like that. Anyway, so Yankees, keep an eye on the Canada game out of the corner of my eye here. And when there's a big three, you're going to be able to tell from me there was a big three. Marcus Stroman against Kevin Gausman tonight. Let's take a look at that one. So Stroman comes in here with a 3.64 ERA. You obviously know Stroman pretty well at this point. ERA up over 5, though, since the start of June. He's been allowing a ton of hard contact. I mean, never a big strikeout guy anyway, but the walks have started to creep up on him a little bit. That splitter he throws is still really strong. It's got an 89th percentile run value as an off-speed pitch, but he only really throws it to lefties, and even against lefties, it's only his number 3 pitch. So given the results of some of his other pitches, his sinker and cutter both have iffy results, and I know that those play well off each other and set up the other pitches, but from a pure numbers standpoint and the way his outings have gone since the start of June, maybe a case to dial back the fastball a little bit, introduce that splitter a little bit more, get back to being that, you know, I mean, he's always a heavy ground ball guy anyway with that sinker, but the splitter can do even more to help keep that ball on the ground, and it's been his best pitch so far this year. Righties are going to see the sinker, the slider, the cutter, and the slurve. Lefties are going to see the sinker, the cutter, the splitter, and the slurve. There's a slider he'll mix in. There's a curveball he'll mix in. 6 different pitches. He's all over the place these days. It's really fun to watch him. He hasn't seen this Blue Jays team a ton, in part because all the Blue Jays are new and haven't seen any major league pitchers a lot. 60 plate appearances overall against active Blue Jays today. They have a 245 average and a 396 slug against him. Springer's 4-for-16. Vlad's 3-for-12 with no extra base hits and a 39% swing and miss rate, which is huge for Vlad. Varsho's actually 2-for-9 and has homered off him twice. So maybe a Dalton Varsho game here. On the other side, Kevin Gausman comes in, 4.44 ERA. Obviously a pretty up and down season. Still decent strikeout numbers, with a couple blips, pretty good walk numbers. But the stuff metrics are down on his fastball and his splitter. A lot of hard contact for him as well. He has faced the Yankees a lot. They have 236 plate appearances against Kevin Gausman as a group. They've hit 240 off him with a 420 slugging. Aaron Judge is 11-for-37 against him with 5 homers. Giancarlo Stanton, 7-for-19 with two homers. Juan Soto, 7-for-13 with a homer. The rest of the Yankees, even in pretty good samples, have all struggled with Kevin Gausman, but their big three there of Judge, Soto, and Stanton have been able to get to him. Again, Judge and Soto have just been so ridiculous on the year anyway. They're first, they're second and third in wins above replacement in the American League. They're first and second in weighted runs created plus in all of Major League Baseball. They're both hitting over 300 and getting on base at over a 430 clip. Judge has 39 homers and 99 RBI already, and Soto has 27 and 77. It is ridiculous. And now, yeah, they've got Giancarlo Stanton back, and the results are not the level of peak Giancarlo Stanton, but he hits the heck out of the ball. They are the number one offense in baseball by runs per game and weighted runs created plus. They're second in OPS and second in home runs. So this is a team that can really put a number up on you. And like I said, they scored 45 or 46 runs during this five-game win streak. They can fill it up. A couple texts to close us out here before we go. Rob on Twitter asked, are we likely to see Danny Jansen return to the Jays next season, or is it likely he signs with the Bo Sox or elsewhere? I don't know. Likely, I wouldn't say, because likely to me implies, you know, it's higher than 50%. I think there's a chance. Ben Nicholson-Smith told us yesterday that the Jays had talked extension with Danny Jansen before the season, so maybe there's a misalignment in valuing there. But he's well-liked here. The Jays are going to need a catcher. Wouldn't shock me, but I would take the field over the Jays. I don't think it's, you know, a 50-50 kind of thing. Mitch and Lindsay ask, aside from Aurelvis Martinez, who's the most intriguing Jays prospect currently? Yeah, it would have been Ricky Tiedemann before all this injury stuff. Scout people still rave about the quality of the stuff and just how good a pitcher he is when he's actually healthy. But you have to downgrade him a little bit. It's, I mean, it's probably Jake Bloss at this point. That's because of the proximity to the majors as well. If you're looking pure upside, it's probably Arjun Namala, who is still one of the youngest players at A-ball, hit his 11th homer of the season yesterday at a three-hit game. You know, still striking out a lot and questions about whether he'll stay at shortstop, but he's an 18-year-old who's 3 years younger than the average player at A-ball. And for the last couple of weeks since he got back to A-ball after a stint on the developmental list has really hit. Anytime a kid is that young, plays a premium position and shows that kind of power, if you're talking about intriguing, that's intriguing to me. Like 5 years away from being in the major leagues though. So intriguing, but not imminent. Dave and Barry, asked the same Blue Jays question. Also, any predictions for SummerSlam? Yeah, I don't want to give, I mean, it's not giving anything away. I don't know for sure. But yeah, I think the other part of your question, Dave, yeah, Roman Reigns is back on Saturday. We'll see. It'll be a fun one Saturday. So I'm calling, for those who don't know, I do play-by-play for a local indie called Smash Wrestling. We're running a show out of the Rec Room on Saturday, and as part of it, SummerSlam streams there after the event. So the wrestling show that I'm calling on play-by-play starts at 4, and then when it ends, SummerSlam goes up on the big screen at Rec Room. So should be a fun wrestling weekend and a fun baseball weekend. Bruce from Digby, Nova Scotia asks, does George Springer have a Gold Glove Award? He does not. Couple Silver Sluggers. He does not have one. I don't know if this question was wondering if he's going to get one this year. I would say he is not. He's had a nice season in right field. It's looked a lot of fun, some highlight reels. But the way that the Gold Glove voting works is there's a manager and six coaches from each team. You can't vote for your own guy. And then there is also a statistical component. We don't get told exactly how that works out, but the defensive metrics that we see publicly, at least, grade George Springer out as, yeah, good, but not like elite among right fielders. So, you know, my eye test says a little better than that. I think he's been pretty nice out there. It's been a fun year for him in right field. But there is a statistical component to the Gold Glove Awards. And I don't know that he would, I think he'd come out just good, not elite with those. John from Toronto asks, what kind of GM would you like during the offseason? He'd like to see an aggressive AJ Preller type. If the Jays have 75 mil to fill out the roster, what about adding one or two impactful players rather than rounding it out? Yeah, I'm with you on that part, John. The Jays have done a good job having a good bench, developing guys that are, you know, a David Schneider type, a Spencer Horwitz type. They acquired Will Wagner, Lo Profito, Jonathan Class A. They've got the depth pieces covered. What they need to do is go out and add an impact bat, probably two impact bats if you can. You know, you look specifically third base, left field, second base, one or two of those positions. That is how I would spend the money. I would earmark some of it for pitching depth that they just haven't had. But like, Rafael Montero got DFA'd the other day in year two of a three-year deal. It's a good warning not to dump too much of your budget into the bullpen, even if you have a bad bullpen. A good front office is going to be able to put that together less expensively than going out and spending eight figures on relievers. So yeah, I'm probably focusing that money that you have available to spend on, you know, you're not spending all $75 million on two guys. That level of guy just isn't out there unless you get Juan Soto. But yeah, I'm focusing on the guys at the high end who change your ceiling and change your upside. We are just about done for today. Thank you to Ben Schulman, Jay Triano, Bob Lorenz, and Chris Cotillo for coming on and joining us today. Thank you to Andrew Adams, Amit Mann, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. It's Kevin Gausman against Marcus Stroman at 7:05 tonight down at Yankee Stadium. It'll be Ben, Buck, and Hazel on the TV side, Jamie and Madison on Blue Jay Central, Eric and Caleb on the radio side, and Shai Davides on the ground there has us covered. Hope you all have a tremendous weekend. I'll talk to you on Monday.